KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. For the second time this week, President Trump's administration tries for a sweeping change in the federal government. The administration offered millions of federal workers a deal to quit. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The administration also tried to pause trillions in federal payments until a judge paused the pause. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A freeze on foreign aid payments is in effect, and we'll hear what that means for AIDS funding in Africa. Also, how does the U.S. know its nuclear weapons still work? And how does the nation's report card rate kids in school? It's Wednesday, January 29th. This day in 1891, Queen Liliuokalani became Hawaii's last sovereign ruler. Her reign lasted just under 2 years until a U.S.-supported coup. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Senate confirmation hearings for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. are underway at this hour. President Trump nominated Kennedy as Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Kennedy is criticized for his skepticism of vaccines and other controversial viewpoints. Some employees of the federal government are being offered what the Trump administration is calling deferred resignations with full pay and benefits if they agree to leave their jobs by the end of September. The deadline to decide is a week from tomorrow. NPR's Andrea Shues says this follows President Trump's order on day one to end remote work for federal employees.
I think some workers who have been remote for years since before the pandemic, they may have already been planning to resign, so maybe some of them will. But others I've spoken to this week are really determined to stay in their jobs. You know, they took these jobs because they believe in the mission. They believe in serving the country. They want to be enforcing the law.
NPR's Andrea Hsu reporting. A federal judge is temporarily blocking the Trump administration's plan to freeze federal payments for grants, loans, and other programs, at least until Monday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been invited to the White House. It's President Trump's first White House invitation to a foreign leader since returning to office. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Netanyahu's office says the Israeli leader is invited to meet Trump in the White House next week on Tuesday. Trump and his Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, were instrumental in pressing Netanyahu to reach a ceasefire and hostage-prisoner exchange with Hamas on the eve of Trump's inauguration. The Trump administration is urging Israel to extend the ceasefire. Netanyahu is under pressure from far-right allies to return to fighting in Gaza. Netanyahu is scheduled to testify 3 times a week in his corruption trial, and it's unclear if the Israeli court will grant him a reprieve for a White House visit. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks open mixed as investors wait to hear from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell this afternoon. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow rose about 30 points in early trading.
Powell and his Fed colleagues are widely expected to hold interest rates steady today as the central bank tries to wrestle inflation back down to its target of 2%. Prices are still climbing a little bit faster than that. There's also considerable uncertainty about how President Trump's policies will affect the cost of living, so the Fed is likely to proceed with caution. The nation's trade deficit hit a record high in December, topping $122 billion. Exports were down during the month while imports jumped. Some of the increased imports were the result of businesses hustling to bring goods into the country before any potential Trump tariffs take effect. Stocks were higher in Tokyo today. Most other Asian markets were closed for the Lunar New Year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The Trump administration's halt of refugee programs has stranded thousands of Afghans who helped the U.S. military at war. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports veterans groups are pushing for a change in policy.
Afghans who helped out the U.S. military over 20 years of war were promised U.S. visas, but now thousands of them and their family members are stranded. The suspension of foreign aid also means no support for Afghans that the U.S. has evacuated to third countries. Veterans say they made promises to these Afghan allies. Tim Kennedy is a Green Beret who fought in Afghanistan.
The men that we were fighting alongside in Afghanistan, they would take extraordinary and exceptional risks and demonstrate countless acts of valor in the protection of us.
On his first official day as Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth was asked about the issue. He said the U.S. stands with its allies, but didn't elaborate. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Two Colombian military planes carrying migrants deported from the U.S. arrived in Bogota. The White House has said it would lift visa restrictions and other measures once the Colombian government accepted migrants. Over the weekend, Colombia's president rejected two U.S. military flights of deported migrants from Colombia. President Gustavo Petro and President Trump traded tariff threats until Petro eventually relented. WNBA star Brittany Griner is signing with the Atlanta Dream. Griner made the announcement on Instagram in a video alongside some of her new teammates. She spent her 11-year career with the Phoenix Mercury. She missed the 2022 season when she was detained in Russia for 10 months. She was freed in a prisoner swap. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Two actions this week show the scope of President Trump's bid to reshape the federal government.
The president issued a sweeping order to pause trillions of dollars in payments. Just as that was supposed to go into effect, a federal judge temporarily blocked it. And the administration added another proposal offering millions of federal employees a chance to quit.
In a moment, we'll hear from a former top budget official in the George W. Bush administration. First, NPR White House correspondent Esma Khalid is here to talk about it all. Esma, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so the memo was going out to workers last night, I heard. What exactly is the federal government offering its employees?
The administration says it's giving employees the option to resign, be put on leave, and continue to be paid through September. It's a big move with the goal to shrink the government. The union that represents many federal workers described this effort as a purge of dedicated civil servants, and it does not consider the move voluntary. Under this new Trump administration, people in the federal workforce feel like they are being seen as the enemy in a way that they have never been viewed by prior administrations, either Republican or Democrat. And Steve, you know, being a government worker was once seen as a steady, secure job. But right now, federal workers feel like their jobs are very precarious, and that is indeed the intention. Trump wants government workers in line with his vision. He campaigned on remaking federal government. He campaigned on reshaping government as a whole. He telegraphed a lot of his decisions, and now he is following through, just perhaps more swiftly than expected.
Now, this email to federal workers, I guess it'll be played out. Maybe it'll go to court. We'll find out what happens in the hours and days to come. But then there's this other memo pausing payments, trillions of dollars worth of payments, it said yesterday. What exactly was the federal government trying to do with that?
It was a memo, Steve, that sparked utter chaos and confusion when it was issued by the Office of Management and Budget. It called for a temporary freeze in federal funds, grants, loans, other forms of assistance. It was a sweeping directive with little clarity. And Trump's press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, spent a bulk of the White House press briefing yesterday defending the freeze.
And the reason for this is to ensure that every penny that is going out the door is not conflicting with the executive orders and actions that this president has taken.
What she's referring to there are programs related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, as well as climate and just general overspending. But the memo was so broad that it was not clear what programs would be affected. The White House clarified that direct services like Medicaid, Social Security, and food stamps would not be impacted, but also did not articulate if financial assistance that comes through nonprofits, think, for example, of food banks, whether those might be affected.
What was the response to all of this?
Well, Democrats raised alarm bells and accused Trump of violating the Constitution. Nonprofits expressed concern about cuts to services they provide. Diane Yentl is the CEO of the National Council of Nonprofits, which represents a network of some 33,000 nonprofits. She says this freeze could lead to catastrophic consequences.
We're talking about potentially shutting down shelters for survivors of domestic violence or shelters for people experiencing homelessness.
And so she was amongst a group that filed a legal challenge over Trump's move. And just as this directive was about to go into effect at 5 p.m. yesterday, a federal judge intervened.
The charge being here that Congress, not the president, set spending. So what's the ruling mean?
You know, it just allows sort of a bit of breathing room, at least until Monday. That is when a follow-up hearing is planned with more fulsome arguments on the merits of the case. Steve, I will say the courts seem to be really the arena where the fights around Trump's changes will play out. No. You know, for example, you're also seeing legal challenges to the birthright citizenship executive order as well.
NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, thanks so much.
Good to speak with you.
And we have some analysis now from James Capretta, who's with the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington think tank that advocates for free enterprise. What's pertinent here is that he was an associate director of the Office of Management and Budget under Republican President George W. Bush. Mr. Capretta, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
What did you think about when you saw this memo that essentially said pause $3 trillion in federal spending?
Well, I think it was one of those directives that probably got issued from on high without people thinking through what the legal authorities are. So new administrations come in and they often do try to pause new actions to try to make sure their policies and vision for how to run things can be implemented gradually going forward. So I'm quite sure we did, you know, the administration I worked in probably did something similar, but it was prospective. Mm-hmm. Don't sign any new contracts, don't put out any new big programs yet. Let the new people come in and review new actions going forward. But they didn't do that. They put out a memo that said stop everything, even stuff that was signed and, you know, committed to months and years ago. And there's no real legal authority to do such a thing.
I just want to be clear on this. I'm just thinking about the United States government. We do this collectively over time. There's a passing of a baton from one administration to the other, but each administration has to honor the commitments of the one before to the extent that the law requires. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, so and there's a lot of statutes governing how money is spent already in place, and you can't ignore them all.
And is this also an issue in that Congress has approved the spending and that limits the president's authority to ignore what Congress has passed?
That's correct. So most of this money is in appropriated accounts, and there was an appropriations bill. A continuing resolution is currently in place, but there was a previous appropriation bill that had stipulations around what the money would be used for, and all that continues until amended.
But it sounds like, from what you said, the administration could have done less, could have issued a more focused memorandum, and people might not have liked it, but nobody would have been able to go to a judge and block it.
No, of course, yeah, that's very typical. I'm sure, quite sure the Biden administration did something similar, you know, stop new, spending going out the door for new commitments, don't sign new contracts. Let's review what our options are going forward. That kind of memo is very typical and, not to be unexpected. I mean, it's sort of normal as when you have a change in administration.
Now, the campaign talked about impoundment, the power of impoundment, trying to exercise or claim a power for the president to refuse to spend money that Congress appropriates, essentially to take over the authority for how much to spend from Congress. This is not a new argument. What is the law as you understand it right now?
Well, there was a law passed in 1974 that governed how this is supposed to be run. The president can choose to try to impound funds, but must send a message to the Congress saying that's his intention. And then Congress can either act on that and agree and try to rescind the money, or if Congress does nothing, then the money must be spent. So this was signed during the Nixon era when President Nixon tried to push the boundaries of impoundment. Congress pushed back. The legal authorities, the legal statute has been in place since then, half a century. And, it basically leaves in place the basic understanding that preceded it, which is that Congress gets to decide how to, what should be spent from the Treasury.
Power of the purse.
And the president executes it, doesn't get to decide the total amount.
Power of the purse with some limitations, as you mentioned. And we'll find out if that goes to a higher court for some kind of ruling. I want to ask also about this mandate for federal workers, which is being structured as almost a buyout. It's not called a buyout, but if you want to quit now, they'll keep paying you through September 30th. Does that seem within the president's authority?
I doubt it. That there are, of course, in place and have been periodic buyout provisions in law so that the Congress has approved buyouts through special provisions to try to shrink various agencies over time. There was a big one in the 1990s. But my guess is that they've overreached here also in the sense that they have a blanket buyout and with no structure around it. And for everybody in every office and so on, I think that probably goes well beyond what they have the authority to do, as people will discover today as they start to review this.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but Esma Khalid said that federal workers are feeling like they've been made into the enemy in a way they hadn't been by prior administrations, even ones that wanted to cut the government. Do you think that's true?
Yes. I think the president signaled that he was going to, really try to make all the civil service sort of loyal to his vision for the government, and that's what's taking place right now.
James Capretta is a former associate director at the Office of Management and Budget under the second Bush administration. He's now with the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
On a different note, normally our stories about what's on the Billboard music charts come from what's on top. This time, Stephen Thompson of NPR Music found a cool story at the bottom. Here he is.
The Imogen Heap song Headlock debuted on last week's Hot 100 at number 100. This week it soars all the way up to number 98. Why is this newsworthy? Imogen Heap's pioneering electropop career stretches back roughly three decades, but she's never landed one of her own songs on Billboard's main pop chart until now. What makes this especially strange, Imogen Heap had to wait 20 years for this song to take off. Headlock is from her 2005 album, Speak for Yourself. It turns out the song has been part of a social media trend wherein users place it over footage from the horror video game Mouthwashing. That's led to a surge in streaming for Headlock. Imogen Heap has won two Grammys. She's influenced generations of pop, hip-hop, and R&B musicians. She contributed to Taylor Swift's album 1989, and this a cappella song of hers, Hide and Seek, helped Jason Derulo score his first number one song when he sampled it for What You Say. So tell me, girl. That's quite a career, but it took a video game she had nothing to do with, to finally land Imogen Heap's own work on the Hot 100 in its own right. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, our anti-social century. We talk with Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson about how loneliness is shaping our politics, personalities, and sense of reality. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The United States maintains an arsenal of thousands of nuclear weapons, but it hasn't tested one in decades. Instead, the U.S. is using simulations and experiments to see if the nukes still work. NPR's Jeff Brumfield got a peek into the testing program in the desert outside Las Vegas.
I'm standing out here on the Nevada National Security Site. It used to be the test site, and in the 1950s, this is where they actually tested nuclear weapons out in the open.
4, 3, 2, 1.
And there's all sorts of debris out here. You can see bent steel girders, blasted concrete. All these years later, it's still here. Also lingering for years, the invisible fallout from these tests. Radioactive elements found their way into the water, the air, even the baby teeth of children living downwind at the time. That's part of the reason why in 1963, the U.S. and other nuclear powers signed a treaty to move nuclear weapons testing to tunnels deep underground. And that's where we're headed. We step into an old mining elevator.
All right, watch your step getting onto the cage.
And drop into pitch blackness. My ears pop as we descend nearly 1,000 feet to one of America's most secretive scientific laboratories. NPR was among a handful of news outlets allowed inside, and we were the only ones allowed to record the sounds of the lab deep underground. There's a long corridor that's been carved out of an ancient lake bed. Pipes along the walls carry air, water, and power. Workers in hard hats are everywhere. David Funk, who oversees work underground, leads us in.
How long have we had tunnels then?
Oh, so the tunnels, these were dug in the 80s.
So this would have been a test shaft, potentially.
Yeah, this was designed to be nuclear test location originally, and now we do only subcritical experiments in this location.
Subcritical experiments. That means experiments that simulate conditions inside a nuclear weapon without triggering a nuclear chain reaction. That runaway chain reaction is what gives a nuke its incredible power. These tunnels were originally built to contain nuclear explosions. Then, in 1992, the U.S. officially stopped all testing. The Cold War had ended, and the thinking was nuclear testing could end too. It would make the world safer. But fast forward to today, and nuclear weapons are back on the front pages. Same goes for nuclear testing. China, Russia, and America are all upgrading their test sites. And that's why we're here, to see what U.S. scientists are up to underground. Speaking of which, why do they still work down here?
We do this because it is secure, right, so we can control the environment. And we also are concerned about a potential breach of the vessel, and so we want to do it in an environment that's controlled and we don't lose any of the plutonium into the environment.
If something goes wrong.
If something goes wrong, yeah.
We arrive at our first stop, a long, empty corridor that's just been dug out for a new experiment.
So this is where the Scorpius machine is going to reside.
The Scorpius machine. It kind of feels like you're in a James Bond movie. Funk explains it's actually a giant X-ray machine.
You guys are familiar with chest X-rays, right?
Scorpius is going to work in the same way. It'll create extremely high-powered X-rays.
And the reason is we need higher energy X-rays to be able to look through plutonium.
Plutonium from America's nuclear weapons. Much of it was made decades ago, and it's getting old. The X-rays are used to take a look inside to see how well the plutonium would work if detonated. Scorpius will cost $2 billion to build down here. We walk deeper into the tunnel network. Some of the floors are still rocky. They've just been dug. Next stop, an experiment that simulates a nuclear weapon. It's called Cygnus, and it's arguably the most secretive scientific project in the U.S. government.
As a reminder, the area we're going into, no cell phones. Any Bluetooth devices, smartwatches, smart rings. If you have them, they need to go in the locker over here.
Cygnus is a smaller version of Scorpius. It fires X-rays at plutonium that's inside a spherical steel container about the size of a mini fridge.
Watch your step, entering.
Tim Beller is directing the next test, codenamed Knob Hill.
So that is the Knob Hill vessel. That's the actual vessel that we will use. That's a three-footer.
In a few months inside this vessel, scientists will blow up a tiny quantity of plutonium using chemical explosives. It's designed to simulate a nuclear detonation, but again, this test will be subcritical. The U.S. government says there will not be a runaway nuclear chain reaction.
Whatever rules they set, I ensure they happen here in Nevada.
Globally, some arms control experts worry the rules might soon change. A treaty to permanently ban nuclear testing is stalled. Russia is developing new kinds of nukes, and China is dramatically increasing the size of its nuclear arsenal. Both countries are upgrading their nuclear test sites, just like the U.S. Don Haynes is a nuclear weapons scientist from Los Alamos National Laboratory, which built the first bomb in 1945. He says there's no immediate need for the U.S. to test a nuclear weapon these days.
I think the question is more about, well, you know, if we return to testing, others might. Who would gain more marginal benefits?
Before nuclear testing ended in the 90s, China conducted just 45 tests. Many experts believe that they, more than anyone else, could learn a lot if nuclear testing were to resume. The U.S., by contrast, conducted more than 1,000 nuclear tests. Scientists like Haynes could conduct one more, a system test of an entire weapon, but right now?
Our assessment is that there are no system questions that would be answered by a test that would be worth the expense and the effort and the time.
Still, he adds, the decision whether or not to test is above his pay grade. Ultimately, it'll be up to the politicians and the generals to choose whether America should detonate another nuclear weapon in these tunnels. From beneath the Nevada desert, Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Later on All Things Considered, Jeff takes us to the California supercomputers that conduct virtual nuclear tests. Listen live on the NPR app or your station. This is NPR News.
Christy Dashiell is nominated for her first Grammy Award for a jazz album that shows off her vocal range and emotional depth.
The human themes of love, loss, grief, joy, friendship, all of us can relate to that, black, white, brown, whatever.
I'm Elsa Chang. More on her new album, Journey in Black, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Wondering where...
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's choice to lead the Department of Health and Human Services is testifying this morning at his Senate confirmation hearing. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was criticized in the opening minutes of the hearing by the ranking Democrat on the committee, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, for his previous statements about the effectiveness of vaccines.
Mr. Kennedy has embraced conspiracy theories, quacks, charlatans, especially when it comes to the safety and efficacy of vaccines.
Kennedy is expected to face questions about his positions on vaccines as well as abortion rights and other issues. Last week's order from the Trump administration to stop all U.S. foreign aid is affecting people with HIV/AIDS. NPR's Fatma Tanis says clinics around the world have shut down, including ones in sub-Saharan Africa.
The clinics that people went to get their medications for HIV/AIDS have closed down. This is happening in South Africa, in Tanzania, in other countries too. You can even see on Google Maps some of these clinics have now temporarily closed in their description.
It's unclear how long the freeze will affect those clinics. The U.S. trade deficit hit a record high in December as exports declined and imports jumped. That's according to the Commerce Department. This is NPR News. ChatGPT maker OpenAI says it believes the Chinese artificial intelligence startup DeepSeek improperly used its data. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, DeepSeek sent a shockwave through the AI industry this week when it said its powerful chatbot was developed at a much lower cost.
OpenAI says DeepSeek dazzled the world with its chatbot only after secretly relying on the proprietary technology that powers ChatGPT. The company says it is investigating what it believes is evidence that China-based DeepSeek trained its AI model on the outputs of ChatGPT. DeepSeek's claim that it built a ChatGPT-like bot with a fraction of the cost rattled stock markets and raised questions about whether Silicon Valley was falling behind China in the AI race. But the White House's AI czar David Sacks said on Fox News that it is possible that DeepSeek stole OpenAI's intellectual property. OpenAI itself is facing numerous copyright infringement lawsuits over scraping nearly the entire internet to develop ChatGPT. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
The British government is backing construction of a third runway at Heathrow Airport outside London. The UK's finance minister is giving the green light to the project, which has been subject to years of environmental and legal challenges. Stocks on Wall Street are mostly lower. The NASDAQ is down 113 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration's order to stop all U.S. foreign aid last week has immediately affected people with HIV/AIDS. Clinics around the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, rely on U.S. funds to provide drugs and treatments to people battling the disease. NPR global health correspondent Fatma Tanis is covering this story. She's with us now. Good morning, Fatma.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what are you hearing from HIV clinics?
Well, we're hearing that the clinics that people went to get their medications for HIV/AIDS have closed down. This is happening in South Africa, in Tanzania, in other countries too. You can even see on Google Maps some of these clinics have now temporarily closed in their description. For one example, a clinic in South Africa posted a message on X yesterday telling people to, quote, visit the clinic before 4 p.m. to collect your medications before they closed their doors. This is happening in U.S.-supported clinics all over sub-Saharan Africa, according to an HIV access group called HealthGap. And so people who are using these services who depend on a regular course of AIDS medication to keep them from spreading the disease, they don't have access to these drugs now.
So back up for a minute, Fatma. I'm thinking some people might be surprised that the U.S. is so involved in making HIV/AIDS treatment available around the world. Say a little bit about how that happened.
Well, the U.S. has been a very generous provider of AIDS assistance programs around the world through an effort called PEPFAR. That's the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Response. It was started under President George W. Bush. It's a program with a lot of bipartisan support, and it's credited with having saved at least 25 million lives. Now, those clinics we just talked about all received support from PEPFAR. And PEPFAR is funded through the State Department. And when the Trump administration froze foreign aid and issued a stop work order on existing programs, that applied to PEPFAR as well.
Okay, so say more. How did that all play out?
So big organizations that partner with the U.S. on HIV/AIDS, as well as NGOs and clinics working in countries where the disease is common, they have all received orders from the U.S. to stop work immediately. Now, Atul Gawande confirmed this as well. He was an assistant administrator in global health during the Biden presidency. He told Melody Schreiber, a freelance journalist who contributed to our reporting on this, that clinics have, quote, stopped distributing medications and PEPFAR central information systems were shut down. The Trump administration says the freeze will be in effect for about 3 months. Now, late last night, the State Department added a waiver to that freeze in a memo that was obtained by NPR. The waiver allows money to continue flowing for core life-saving medications. But it's unclear what that means and if AIDS drugs would be included. So there's more to know on this.
So if the freeze does cover AIDS medications, if it's determined that those aren't, quote, core life-saving medications, as you just described it, how many people would be affected?
You know, Michelle, 20 million people around the world are relying on PEPFAR-funded programs. That could be for medications to prevent the disease or treat it, but also nutritional support for pregnant women and people living with AIDS. And at least 220,000 patients are visiting these clinics daily. And now here's why these drugs are so important. Taking them consistently keeps the viral load down. It helps prevent the spreading of the disease. And if you stop taking your medications, within a few weeks, the virus can multiply, leading to illness. It can also spread more easily. And also, it leads to the virus developing resistance. Now, I've been speaking to sources who've worked on PEPFAR, and they're very concerned by what's happening. One person who spoke on the condition of anonymity out of fear of losing their job told me that, quote, people are going to die in other countries because of the stop work order.
That is NPR's Fatma Tanis. Fatma, thank you.
Thank you.
Every 2 years, we get a rare glimpse of how the nation's students are doing in math and reading.
It comes from the nation's report card, that's what it's called. The latest results are out today and have a lot to say nearly 5 years after the pandemic first closed schools.
NPR's Corey Turner has been looking at the data. Corey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so how are our students doing?
Well, this is not the report card we were hoping for. These results come from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which was created by Congress. It's been around for decades. Every other year, the country tests a sample of fourth and eighth graders, and we're talking reading and math. And the last time we got results in 2022, they showed steep learning losses from the pandemic. So the hope was when students took these tests again in 2024, we might see them doing better. Well, here's Peggy Carr. She is commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics.
These results are sobering. We're not where we need to be or where we want to be at this point.
Now, Steve, as bleak as that sounds, I actually want to start with one glimmer of hope in those sobering results. Fourth graders who took the math test in 2024 actually did a little better than the fourth graders who took it in 2022.
Okay.
And that's really important because it ends a pandemic slide in fourth grade math.
Okay, so that bit of good news amid some not so good news, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of not so good news, because even in fourth grade math, kids still aren't back to the scores we saw before the pandemic. In fact, when you break the data down, in only one state, Steve, Alabama, are fourth graders doing better in math than fourth graders were doing before the pandemic. One state. And in eighth grade, there's a really worrying achievement gap that's been widening between top and lower performers.
Well, this is disturbing at a time when education is so closely linked to people's success later in life. How are kids doing in reading?
Well, that may be the toughest news of all. In fourth and eighth grade, both reading scores continued to fall from 2022 to 2024. And keep in mind, they'd already been falling from 2019 to 2022. The lowest performers in reading are actually scoring worse now than the lowest performers who took the test 30 years ago.
Wow.
And remember how I said only one state had surpassed its pre-pandemic math scores? Well, it is the same in reading. In only one state are fourth graders doing better than they were in 2019, and that is Louisiana.
What happened to all the money that the federal government spent since the peak of the pandemic to try to make up for some of the pandemic educational losses?
Yeah, so $190 billion. That is a lot of money, you're right. But several researchers told me, look, that money helped, just not enough. And part of the reason why is because Congress sent most of it directly to districts. They had a lot of freedom in spending it, and they were only required to spend a small fraction of it on learning loss. I also want to say, though, these declines in math and reading, Steve, when you look big picture, they were made worse by the pandemic, but they actually started before COVID, around a decade ago. And researchers told me understanding why is going to be key to getting kids back on track. This big report card, it's great for understanding where kids are struggling, but not why or what we can do about it.
Really appreciate that insight that this would have slide would have started before the pandemic, something bigger going on. Corey, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve.
That's NPR's Corey Turner. This is NPR News.
When you tear down a building to make way for a new one, all that lumber and metal goes straight to the landfill. So, can you recycle a house? That's next time on Here and Now.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Fat Tuesday comes this year in early March, and for those who can't wait, there is a parade in February in space. For the first half of next month, six planets will be lined up and visible in our night sky. You will be able to see Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn after the sun sets. And if you have a telescope, you'll see signs of Neptune and Uranus. That's Uranus, not Uranus. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Gaza ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is holding into its second week, and for the moment seems even to apply hundreds of miles outside of Gaza. Houthi fighters who control much of Yemen are apparently observing this ceasefire. At the height of the war, you will recall, these allies of Hamas were conducting attacks on ships that passed by Yemen's coast. NPR's Greg Myrie is following all this from Tel Aviv. Hey there, Greg.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, how committed are the Houthis to this ceasefire?
Well, they are observing it with the caveat. The Houthis say they're scaling back attacks as long as the truce holds. The Houthis say they may still fire on ships affiliated with Israel, but, you know, given the complex nature of ship ownership, it's often difficult to tell who owns a particular ship.
Yeah.
The Houthis have waged this missile campaign against commercial ships through the Red Sea off the west coast of Yemen throughout the Gaza war. They said they were acting in solidarity with the Palestinians. We'll have to see how it actually plays out, but no reports of Houthi missile attacks over the past 10 days.
Okay, useful to hear that. But didn't the Houthis also take and hold some hostages?
Yeah, that's right. 25 crew members on a ship called the Galaxy Leader were released from Yemen recently, given over to neighboring Oman. Oman negotiated the release, and this was announced last week. The Houthis seized this crew way back in November 2023, just a month after the Gaza war began. So this crew had been held for more than a year.
Okay, so they're not firing at ships. They've released the hostages. Does this mean the United States Navy can scale back its effort to defend commercial ships in the Red Sea nearby?
Yes, Steve. I mean, this was a very substantial operation by the Navy, and it may be a little too early to know for sure if these ships' attacks have permanently stop. But if we do reach that point, the Navy is likely to pull back or withdraw. But in another development, President Trump has reinstated the Houthis on the U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations. Trump put them on the list in his first term. Then President Biden took them off, citing humanitarian concerns in Yemen. And now Trump has put them back on. Here's Michael Knights at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
It might seem a little odd that the Houthis are taking these de-escalatory steps at the same time the Trump administration takes an escalatory step. But I think the Trump administration views the Houthis as a longer-term threat that needs to be contained and eventually removed.
So when we step back from all these news items you've informed us about, what does this mean ultimately for shipping traffic in the Red Sea?
Yeah, this is one of the busiest shipping channels in the world. Traffic had been down as much as two-thirds. It was starting to pick up recently and should now pick up pretty rapidly, according to Knights.
We can already see oil tankers beginning to come back into the Red Sea in larger numbers.
So he says oil companies have a long history of operating in this volatile region and are therefore more willing to accept risks than, say, regular container ships.
What happens for the world economy if those container ships come back in the pre-war numbers?
Yeah, the big winner would be Egypt, which lost hundreds of millions of dollars in fees because ships weren't using Egypt's Suez Canal, which connects the Red Sea and Mediterranean. Most have been taking a much longer route, an expensive route around the southern tip of Africa. And overall, the Houthis carried out about 100 ship attacks. They sank two of them and killed several crew members.
Okay, and the attacks have stopped for now. NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Thank you.
consumers are getting worried.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Rubrik, dedicated to giving businesses the power to bounce back fast when cyber attacks target the cloud. More at Rubrik.com. And by VantageScore, a leading credit score now mandated for use in the conventional conforming space. Loans purchased by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Go to VantageScore.com for more information on the change.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Consumers got more downbeat on the economy here in the dawn of 2025. There'd been pretty steady improvement in consumer sentiment through last summer and early fall as inflation moderated and mortgage rates fell briefly. But now consumers are anticipating worse to come. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index fell sharply in January for a second month in a row. Senior economist Stephanie Guichard says consumers have become more worried about future unemployment. They also expect inflation to pick up in the coming year after seeing some key prices rise recently.
What matters for them is how much they pay for their gas, for their eggs, their cars.
Another thing that's affecting consumer sentiment, a change of power in Washington.
There is this sort of switcheroo happening.
Chris Jackson at polling firm Ipsos says when political control shifts, consumers respond.
Democratic positive attitudes about the economy really collapsed the day after the election. Republican positive attitudes are going up, but they're not all the way to the point where Democrats were before the election.
Jackson expects Republican sentiment to keep improving now that President Trump is in office, pushing overall consumer sentiment higher in coming months. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Trump administration is offering a kind of buyout package to federal workers. The administration sent out a memo saying government employees can choose to resign and get paid through September or face the chance of layoffs later. Meanwhile, the president removed two members of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, as well as one member of the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. Those agencies can be hobbled without the requisite number of appointed leaders. Marketplace's Nova Safo has that.
President Trump fired Jocelyn Samuels and Charlotte Burroughs, who were serving terms on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which weren't set to expire until next year at the earliest. Gwen Wilcox, the first black woman to serve on the National Labor Relations Board, was also fired. The moves leave both agencies without the quorums they need among their appointed leadership, which means the NLRB can't issue rulings on pending cases, and the EEOC can't take certain major actions, such as adopting new rules. All of those fired indicated they may legally challenge their firings, and it's an open legal question whether Trump can fire them. According to the 1935 law that created the NLRB, members of its board can only be fired for, quote, neglect of duty or malfeasance. There's less clarity for the EEOC, but no previous president has fired a commissioner before their term expired. This legal question could end up at the Supreme Court for a final resolution. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Glassdoor. Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life. Learn more at glassdoor.com.
The average American tax filer spends more than $200 on tax prep each year, TurboTax, H&R Block, TaxSlayer, things like that. The IRS has been piloting a system to go around the intermediaries. Now in its second year, Direct File is free and is available to more of the country. Daniel Ackerman has more.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say you probably don't love tax season as much as this guy.
I actually had my bachelor party on April 15th, which is tax day. I look forward to taxes.
Jeremy Bearfriend is a professor of tax law at George Washington University. He says the idea behind Direct File is simple.
We all are obligated to pay, and it's a bit silly that somehow we would have to go then to a private company to actually perform that legal and civic duty.
And it's not like the IRS needs you to deliver all your W-2s and 1099s, says Joe Bankman, a law professor at Stanford.
What's always been infuriating to me
is that the government already has a lot of the information it asks you to provide.
Bankman compares preparing tax returns to paying a credit card bill.
Visa doesn't ask you to keep track of all your receipts each month and then write them down and add them up and fine you if you forget one. That's what the government's doing.
Direct File is available through the IRS website to taxpayers in 25 states, including California, Texas, and New York. Amanda Renteria, CEO of Code for America, says the program is aimed at people with relatively simple returns.
So if you have a lot of complex, couple of houses, et cetera, this is not going to be the right tool for you.
Direct File is also not available for gig economy workers. But Renteria says for a good chunk of American wage earners, Direct File could make doing taxes simpler and cheaper. And on that front, she says the U.S. has fallen behind.
In many countries, you actually get a bill, and then you can actually decide, here you go, I'll pay this. Or if you don't, then you actually have to fill out a larger form.
The tax prep industry in the U.S. opposes Direct File. In a statement to Marketplace, Intuit, the maker of TurboTax, said that, quote, free tax preparation has been available to every American taxpayer for years. And it's true, there are services offering free online tax prep, but, says Jeremy Bearer Friend of George Washington University,
usually that tax filing interaction ends up being an opportunity for upselling.
In his confirmation hearings this month, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent committed to keeping Direct File up and running this year, but made no promises beyond that. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
Stock prices are still shifting after the weekend news. China-based artificial intelligence company DeepSeek has apparently figured out how to do decent ChatGPT-style work on the cheap. The NASDAQ market went up 2% yesterday after a 3% drop the day before. Bloomberg News is reporting that Microsoft is looking into evidence that DeepSeek swiped some of U.S. AI leader OpenAI's intellectual property, but that doesn't change the sense that DeepSeek's system works all right. The NASDAQ is down 0.7%, S&P down 0.3%, the Dow up 84 points, about 0.2%, with the Federal Reserve briefing on the economy and interest rates coming up in about 3 hours. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.